And those sounds from Adnan Jubran, Palestinian Udist, is the intro for Gaza Corner. And the views and opinions expressed on Gaza Corner are not necessarily those of a KALW. And Arik, Rabbi Arik, welcome to Gaza Corner.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I've always called you Arik.
That's fine.
I know. I just want the audience to know. I mean, when I grew up in Hebrew school, I would never call my rabbi just by the first name, but I know it's okay. And I don't know if you remember, but we met when you were the leader of Rabbis for Human Rights in 2015 and visited your office. Do you recall that?
Vaguely. My memory isn't always the greatest, but I know that I certainly remember having seen you here and everything, for sure.
Yeah, and I think we should not assume anything in terms of the listeners being familiar with the work you do, the work of Torah Tzedek. So why don't we start from there and explain the organization, not necessarily the many projects you're involved with, but specifically the ones protecting the very, very vulnerable shepherding and, you know, the Bedouin communities.
Sure. So I've been leading Israeli human rights organizations now for over 28 years, 21, as you indicated, with Rabbis for Human Rights. And since 2017, the organization I founded in 2017, Torah Tzedek. We are a universal human rights organization, which means that on principle, we're always dealing with human rights, both of Jewish Israelis and non-Jews who are part of our society or under our control. Although the work that we do on behalf of Israelis in need of public housing is also very important to us. Certainly what I guess we're probably better known for is our work protecting Palestinian farmers and shepherds. And we in 2006 won a major high court victory, which sets the obligations of security forces, Israeli security forces, to protect Palestinian farmers when they go to work their lands. And in most of the years since then, you would actually see Israeli soldiers protecting farmers next door, even inside settlements, because often the settlements place themselves in the middle of a Palestinian olive grove and then put a fence around the rest. This year, it's been a disaster because, as I said so many times to the people in the army and the army civil administration, those responsible for dealing with these kinds of affairs, we understand that in wartime, there aren't the soldiers available that usually are allocated to protect farmers, Palestinian farmers. But throughout the West Bank, we heard report after report of the army actively preventing the farmers from harvesting. Most people have now given up. In a few places, they were able to somehow get in and harvest, but it's been a huge, huge disaster for Palestinians.
Arik, let me just ask you, one of the major problems is that the distinction between a soldier and a settler are very blurred now because so many of the settlers are the soldiers in the West Bank. And I'm talking the fanatical settlers.
You just took the words out of my mouth. That was going to be my next sentence. That when I talk about soldiers, getting to also what you asked about the shepherds, as we've had three shepherding communities expelled from their homes or because of settler violence forced to flee their homes before the war, and another 16 or so since the war, as one of the people in Wadi Siq, one of the places where there was one of the most violent expulsions, said to me, we always The soldiers and the police have always been on the side of the settlers, but there were a red line. So now there are no red lines because we're in a situation where Palestinians in the West Bank, who are not connected to the barbaric attack on Israelis on October 7th, like Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor. And nobody, almost nobody, is willing to stand and protect Palestinians these days. Even people who were willing before, if there was sometimes someone to talk to, sometimes in the army, the police, now there's just about nobody to talk to or willing to help in any way. And the settlers all too often have been given free rein now because of some international pressure. There's maybe a slight change in that, but still far from what's necessary. So you have, in addition to the regular army units, you have Sfar Midbar, the unit that was created of the Hilltop Youth. And again, we shouldn't put all settlers in one category. They're not all violent religious fanatics. But if you want to find those who most likely are, it's these young people in the Hilltop Youth who don't respect any authority. And for many years, it was always the case that they didn't want to be in the army, they didn't want to be inducted, and the army didn't want to induct them. And then this unit was created. It's now been suspended because of the gathering evidence, which the international community is starting to press Israel on, of the violent activities of this unit supporting the settlers and the outposts and everything else. But in addition to that, the local settler security details have all been given uniforms and generally U.S.-issued guns, said they're now in reserve duty. And very often, when settlers come to invade or the army comes to it, or army and settlers together, because usually they come together, people in uniform and out of uniform, and they show up in the middle of the night to act violently and terrorize a community or to expel farmers trying to harvest their olives, people will say, you know, that guy there over there in the uniform, he's in uniform now, but we know him. He's from the next door outpost. And that's the reality. That is the reality.
And you are where right now? And I know you've worked a shift already. So it's Sunday morning, 11 minutes after 9 o'clock in the morning, wherever you are, but you've actually, maybe take us through the shift that you just did, an overnight shift in trying to protect the people that you're with.
So sadly, many of the communities that we were protecting from August until the war have been forced out of their homes and fled their homes. But there are additional shepherding communities in the gun sites that would very likely have already, some of them have already left their homes, have been forced out of their homes, if we and our partners were not providing a 24/7 protective presence. And we've just had another community that's been added to the list this last Thursday, a place called Moriah Deir, not far from Jerusalem, north of Jerusalem, where a fairly large shepherding community, some 25 families that have been there for over 50 years or almost 50 years, it's been a very quiet place for most of that time. But problems started gathering already this summer, again, before the war. It's important to emphasize that things have gone on steroids since the war, but not to have this illusion that it's only because of the war or only because of this government. But there was a day where a posse of settler vigilantes showed up in the village looking for stolen tractors from a place far, far away from this community. And then ended up arresting somebody that they said had attacked them with a knife or something like this. And then the local outpost, Mizpeh Dani, was expanded, and they couldn't get to their wadi. There's a valley next door where a lot of their grazing land was. They couldn't go there anymore. In another direction, a settler shot at them, or at least pointed a gun at them to keep them out of those lands. And this is all before the war. And then since the war, their last remaining grazing lands they're prevented access, which means that they're paying huge amounts for bought feed. But they were still somehow managing until this last Thursday, when around 10:30 in the morning, settlers showed up, firing in the air, beating people. The residents called the police, but when the police and army came, they backed the settlers, and the Mukhtar of the village, six of his children were arrested, and he was arrested for trying to stand between them and the soldiers. And now these people say they need us to be there, because there are three of the local security guards from different local settlements and outposts to terrorize them. They have problems. Also on Friday, I was about to leave after spending a night on Thursday night. And we had to run to the water station because soldiers, they're denied access to their cisterns in the fields. They have to buy water from the Israeli Water Authority. There are water stations along the road, and they've always been able to do that. But these soldiers, and they weren't even particularly mean soldiers. They were polite and everything, but they said they were new. They said, well, how do we know you're not stealing water? And we're making phone calls, and they're making phone calls until that was settled. So basically, we have people who are on the edge now. Most of them are expressing their determination to stay in their homes. But on Thursday, I certainly heard at least one person saying, I'm going to be out of here. And basically, our presence, along with other things we try to do to work both with Israeli authorities and the international community, may make the difference between whether these people remain in their homes or are added to the list of expelled communities.
And these expelled communities are not likely to return, from what I understand. I mean, the communities disperse. It's not like they leave in one group. And it seems to me the likely scenario of the however many villages have been erased, that these maps will be withdrawn, redrawn.
I think that's true. When people are either expelled or forced to flee from their communities, they don't just lose their homes, they lose their community, because usually the community is dispersed, as you said. They're split up in different places. They're not all together. One of our central messages right now when we're speaking with the international community, including the U.S. administration, is that as welcome as some of the words from President Biden, President Macron, and others about the need to rein in settler violence, as welcome as those words are, not only are words not enough, but it's no longer enough to stop settler violence, because the map has already been redrawn. And so whether you are part of the international community thinking about final status solutions and geopolitics, or whether you are human rights defenders like we are, who are just more concerned about the welfare of human beings, the conditions have to be created to allow these people, enable these people to come home. And many of them do. Many of them want to go home. For that to happen, several things need to happen. A, the nearby outposts need to be removed and can't be allowed to come back.
Which are illegal. I should just, point out, these outposts are not normal settlements, even under Israeli law. They are illegal, correct?
Correct. In other words, all if one accepts that the Fourth Geneva Convention applies in the West Bank, then by definition, all settlements are illegal. Israel doesn't accept that. They say because Jordan was an occupier, which is true. If the Arab world had accepted the Jefferson Plan back in 1947, there would have been a Palestinian state back then. They were occupiers. But Israel says that because we occupied from an occupier, we're not an occupier. And when you strip away the international human rights experts that will always take the Palestinian side or always take the Israeli side, and those who try to be as objective as possible, nobody accepts that argument. It is an occupation. But as you said, the outposts, which, around Deir Mugbayar, there are both settlements and outposts that are causing problems, but the outposts tend to be more aggressive and ideologically committed to expelling Palestinians and dispossessing Palestinians and purposely located in places to do that. So, for example, not far from Deir Mugbayar is El Baka, where an outpost was put on their access road. And actually, the civil administration removed it twice, but they always came back within an hour. So it's not, so A, they have to be removed and they can't be allowed to return. Secondly, there must be closed military areas in which settlers are not allowed to enter, so that the shepherding communities have not only are safe in their homes, but have safe access to their grazing lands and their lands that they plant to grow grains for their animals and what have you. Thirdly, for example, in Zanuta, a shepherding community in the South Hebron Hills, Safriyata, in which already a high court petition has been filed for them to be able to return. First of all, in a very disingenuous manner, the government answered, well, of course they can come back. They, quote unquote, chose to leave. They can choose to come back as a way of not in any way in their answer talking about the conditions that have to be created so that people could come back safely and without fear. But then, in addition to all of that, the civil administration said, of course you can go back, but if you build anything there, you'll get demolition orders. So in some communities, the communities dismantled most of their homes when they fled or were expelled. In other places, the settlers came afterwards and destroyed homes. In some places, some of the structures still remain. But even if we would get rid of the outposts, and even if we would create these areas that settlers can't enter, and even if the army and police, everybody would do their job and enforce them, because you can declare whatever you want, and if it's not enforced, it's meaningless. If these people are not allowed to build, then they can't really come home.
I guess the likelihood of enabling them to be able to build is not there. So it's so hard to even picture some way of these expelled communities returning, because, as you say, I mean, even if all these things actually do line up, the fact is they can't rebuild, and unless that changes, and I don't know who makes that decision. I mean, is it Smotrich? Who makes that decision about whether they can rebuild or not. Because if they can't rebuild, you know, then obviously then they're basically saying they can't return.
Yes, currently Bezalel Smotrich, who is a far-right religious fanatic, not only the Minister of Finance, but has been given control over the civil administration, which makes these decisions. Now, it's important to say, if a home is built without a permit, and remember that that's because consistently ever since 1971 or 72, when Israel dismantled the Palestinian Planning and Zoning Commissions and gave that to the army, they almost never get the master plans required to be able to build, quote-unquote, legally. Although, again, according to the Hague Conventions, as we understand it, those kinds of civilian affairs should never have been taken out of the hands of the occupied people. It should not be Israel's business at all to decide what's legal or illegal. Even given that, Israel does not need to press demolition orders. It could simply decide not to do anything about it. It could even go further and actually create master plans. We are talking, and this basically comes down, it's hard to imagine that Bezalel Smotrich, who asked for that position in addition to the finance ministry specifically, so he could expand settlements and be even more draconian regarding Palestinian building than the civil administration had already been. The bottom line is, will the international community put the required pressure on Israel to allow those things to happen?
Eric, if whenever this war ends, the consensus is Netanyahu's government will be no more. So that means that the Smotriches and the Ben-Gaviers of the world will no longer have their positions, correct?
Well, we're going to be in a liminal moment. It's really difficult to know how the Israeli public is going to react to everything that's happening here. There is a crisis, internal Israeli crisis, like we've never had before. We always used to talk about the Yom Kippur War as a huge crisis, internal crisis within Israeli society, losing faith in our own institutions. But this crisis puts that in the back pocket. It's simply, it may be that the Smotriches will be empowered as people say Likud was, Netanyahu's party was too soft on Hamas or whatever, and therefore we need people that are going to be even more military, use more force. And remember, when Netanyahu goes, in many ways, as crazy as this sounds, he's like the left winger of his party. Anyone who's going to come in after him in Likud is probably going to be more militaristic, more right-wing than Netanyahu. The other possibility, though, is if right now Smotrich's party is also way down in the polls, and basically the right-wing road to power, people like Ben-Gvir, promising personal security. They capitalized on the fear that was created after last Gaza flare-up, when there was fighting in the streets or in many mixed cities inside Israel. Of course, people only remember how Jews were attacked and not how Israeli Palestinians were attacked. But maybe some people wake up and say, all these promises they made came to nothing. And all they were concerned about before the war, from the time they came into power until the war broke out, was trying to push through this judicial overthrow. And we need to try a different direction. That could happen also. That's the essence of a liminal moment, that the, as Victor Turner talks about, they're fraught with danger and also fraught with possibility. Because it really, really, I don't know how Israeli society will go. I'm very concerned that that it could push us to the right, further to the right, as how much further right can we go? But it could actually do the opposite.
You know, one of the major problems is how the media is controlled in Israel, and the pictures are controlled so that the majority of Israelis are not seeing the carnage. They're not seeing the children
Correct.
That are being slaughtered, and they're just being reminded about what happened on October 7th and having,
Correct.
You know, these crazy politicians compare Hamas to Nazis and all this kind of thing. So that there's so much dehumanization that's taking place that there's no empathy for the other side. And that makes it very difficult to have any kind of understanding of the other. And also Israelis, in the case of what the Palestinians that you're protecting, these are not armed resistance, Hamas-supporting kind of Palestinians. These are just shepherds that want to coexist and farm their land. So Israelis are unable to distinguish between, in their mind, Palestinian terrorists and terrorized Palestinians.
Exactly. That's what I've been saying all along. And as I said, it's like Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor. Remember, it wasn't until 1988 the U.S. government apologized to Japanese Americans and began to compensate them, saying what we did was a matter of racial prejudice, wartime hysteria, and a failure of political leadership.
Yeah.
For all the ways that you can't really compare, in many ways, what's happening to Palestinians now is worse than what happened to Japanese Americans. I think that sentence is, those three terms are very, very, very accurate. Listen, it is true, apparently, that there are polls showing, you know, a huge percentage of West Bank Palestinians, 80% or so now, 85 or whatever, supporting Hamas. But they're not really Hamas activists. And we have to ask, what is pushing people into the arms of Hamas? The hardcore Hamas ideologues will want to destroy Israel, even if we have a just peace tomorrow. But you know, our sages taught us many, many, you know, thousands of years ago. They taught that the sword comes into the world because of justice delayed and justice denied and improper teaching of Torah. And they weren't in favor of the sword, but they were realists. And the injustice that Israel is perpetrating through the occupation drives people into the hands of Hamas. It's that simple. And right now, it's true that most, as I said, most Israelis have no bandwidth, no willingness to think about Palestinians in any way. As you said, if you listen to Israeli media, all you hear day in and day out is interviews with bereaved families, with families of hostages, and of course we in the Israeli human rights community have been very much, in addition to calling for a ceasefire, calling for the return of the hostages immediately. I'll say, by the way, that I remember one day doing protective presence, and these Palestinians locked in their homes because they can't safely go anywhere. We're watching just all day long the live feed from Gaza. So they're only seeing the exploded body parts, and they're not hearing about our pain. We are only focused on our pain and not hearing about, not watch anything about the dead babies. Everybody gets furious if you mess with their pain. It's traitorous to say, well, maybe somebody else is suffering. And that is right now pulling us further and further apart. But the bottom line is, even were Israel to succeed in killing every single Hamas member. The sword comes into the world because of justice delayed and justice denied. As long as the source of oppression and anger is not dealt with, there's going to be something else. And in terms of the peace and security, which I want for myself and for my fellow Israelis, it is not going to happen as long as we continue with the occupation. You know, there's an image also in the Talmud where somebody is ritually impure and he goes to the ritual bath to clean himself, to purify himself. But he's holding like a dead lizard or something. And a dead lizard creates impurity. So it's like he keeps on dipping himself in the mikvah, in the ritual bath, but he's going to come out impure because he's still holding the dead lizard. And until we deal with the elephant in the living room, we are not going to get the peace and security that we want and deserve.
Netanyahu wrote an op-ed that I imagine he wanted to get it in the New York Times or maybe the Washington Post. I'm only assuming that. But it was in the Wall Street Journal. And among the points he made was that the war won't end until Hamas is completely obliterated and erased, which is, I think, impossible, quite honestly, because it's actually more of an idea than, you know, it's part of the fabric of Gaza. And I just don't think that's possible. I do think that if somehow it was even possible, something even more extreme would take its place, which feeds into Netanyahu's second point, which is that Israel will stay there until the society is de-radicalized. It's so, to me, completely perverse because he's doing everything possible to radicalize that society by committing a textbook genocide, in my view.
I don't think it's genocide. I think it's more, the better analogies are Hiroshima or Dresden.
But I'll tell you why I think it's genocide.
Go ahead. I was going to say, but the lizard analogy is still there. It's not, we're not going to solve the problem as long as we are continuing to do what we're doing.
I say it's genocide, and so do a lot of people who study genocide for a living, because of two things. One is you have a specific ethnicity that is being killed. By any stretch of the imagination, it is, we're talking one out of every 100 Gazans are dead right now in what, like 80 days. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you have to prove, that can just be a byproduct of war. You have to prove intent. And with all the chutzpah that all the fanatical politicians in the Israeli government possess, they believe they have, you know, impunity for the rest of their lives. So they're willing to say out loud exactly what they want to see happen, which is having Gazans be in a tent city in the Sinai Desert, dropping a nuclear bomb on them. And then that guy, obviously, you know, that was a little too far for Netanyahu, so he got rid of that minister. But there are so many examples of intent to displace the Gazans out of Gaza, and many politicians talking about resettling, especially northern Gaza, with settlements again. So this proves intent, and therefore I say it is textbook genocide. We don't have to debate but that's my point.
It depends how you define genocide.
There's only one definition.
It is not genocide in terms of there are people who have said it, but there is not and will not be an attempt by Israel to murder every Palestinian or even every Gaza. Now, when you talk about moving people out, there is a much more serious stream of thought within the decision makers of what we can call ethnic cleansing. And in other words, I don't think ethnic cleansing and genocide are the same. I mean, then we could talk about what's cultural genocide.
But ethnic cleansing
is not going to be the murder of all Palestinians. But there could be a serious attempt to entirely cleanse Gaza of a Palestinian presence. That could happen if people within this government would be allowed to do so by the international community.
Ethnic cleansing morphs into genocide. Example would be the Armenian genocide. That was determined to be genocide after the ethnic cleansing resulted in so many Armenians killed. So ethnic cleansing can be a precursor to genocide. But anyway, let's move off of that. It's mass slaughter, however you want to look at it. I want to get back to one thing you said before about how Biden has tried to rein in the extremist Jewish settlers by instituting, we didn't bring this up yet, but I want to bring it up now, by instituting a travel ban on these settlers. But there's a giant loophole because, and this is an article that's linked at the Tangents playlist. There's a whole Gaza Corner section there with many links. And one of them is from the Guardian newspaper. And the headline is, "How American Citizens Are Leading Rise of Quote-Unquote Settler Violence on Palestinian Lands." Because if you hold a U.S. passport, you cannot be barred from your own country. And there are some 100,000 American settlers living in settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And many of them are the leaders of these are people that have been there for many years, and this is their dream that's coming to fruition now. They are, I mean, the leaders of a lot of this violence. What do you say to that?
Well, if it's any cold comfort, I would say that today Americans are less prominent in the vanguard of the most violent and aggressive settlers, although they are still very present in the ideological leadership. But the whole thing of banning is almost irrelevant, because not many of these people who would be banned really want to come to the United States. It's maybe a shot across the bow to say that we're concerned, but it's really not an effective measure, even for the people where for whom you could institute the ban. It's just, they're not all lining up to come to America right now. Although there is a serious question, what degree that they are raising money in America and even exploiting the ability to use some kind of 501c3 to get tax deductible donations for the occupation and for the violence. There are other measures, the banning of certain gun sales. There are other kinds of things which it seems the United States is starting to do, which are more serious. But when I speak to people from the international community, and particularly from the United States, the bottom line is that let me say this. I would say that the level of settler violence goes up and down, even during this war. I mean, sometimes it seems like some of this pressure is having impact and some of the over-the-top violence, there's less of it. There seems to be slightly more calm in Masafer Yatta, for example. But then you see something like this attack that happened on Thursday, or the places where just recently settlers have come in to dismantle things that have been homes have been left in communities that were abandoned. And the bottom line is, even if we want to give credit that there's a serious intent by some people in the Biden administration and other countries to try to rein in settler violence, the pressure that's being put on is not yet sufficient to really stop the violence. And B, stopping the violence, as I said, is no longer enough. People have to be brought home. So, and that even requires another level of pressure. And you know, when the international community wants to do it, they know how. Back in 2018, when the Israeli government seemed very intent on destroying Khan al-Ahmar and Susa, two Palestinian communities that have become symbols. And what I would hear from people in the international community is, we can't tell you just what we're doing, but know that we're doing something behind the scenes. And the proof is in the pudding. Those communities are still standing. Although right now, Susa is also one of the endangered communities, where after settlers have gone throughout all the South Hermit Hills, Musafir Yatik communities and threaten people with guns and say, you got to be out of here in 24 hours and what have you. So I don't feel like I need to know just how they're doing it. But clearly, the international community has the ability to put a stop to this if they're willing to expand the political capital, if they're willing to really be truly determined and not just window dressing, but truly determined to stop this. And that's the question. Do they or don't they? So far, we have not really seen this being stopped.
Senator, the late Senator Feinstein's office, I think more than any congressional or Senate office, did the most to keep Susa standing. And I don't know if there's another really significant, you know, political player in Congress that has that kind of stature to make a difference, because Senator Feinstein could call Netanyahu directly. You know, if Rashida Tlaib is, you know, raising her voice, really no one cares, which is very sad. I do want to point out that one of the links at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist at tangents.com is called Susa Journal, and it's by David Shulman with photographs by Margaret Olin. And David, who was going to be on Gaza Corner tonight along with you, Arik, but had another commitment at the last moment, he writes in first-person eyewitness journal accounts of what it's like to do what you were doing earlier today, protecting Palestinians who are vulnerable. And he talks about Susa, talks about other villages where armed soldiers come in or settler youth come in with M16s and pistols and knives and pound on the door and terrorize the children and say, you've got to be out by tomorrow. And then they come back tomorrow. And if you're not gone, you know, you take a risk as to whether they are going to actually kill you or not. But those writings are there, and they're really good writings. David Shulman's a wonderful writer, and I do recommend...
David, who is a longtime active Tayush and also now in Torah Tzedek, and of course has several books such as Dark Hope, which are well worth reading. And I highly, highly recommend reading on a regular basis that photo blog that you mentioned, Touching Photographs, along with Margaret Olin, which I guess can be found in the Gaza Corner website. You can also just Google Touching Photographs. And David is one of the few people that I envy for his writing ability. He writes so beautifully and poetically and touchingly and in a way, and movingly, in a way that really gets to the heart of the issues. And as you mentioned, he's not just sitting at home and writing. What he writes is based on his, he is one of the people in Torah Tzedek and through his other commitments that is really out there on the ground experiencing these things first person in life. And so it's, in some ways, it's amazing that any Palestinians are remaining sumud, that are remaining in their homes against that kind of pressure. And you can't fault anybody who, after having had someone come around with a gun and threatening you in the middle of the night, decide, okay, we need to go. And again, the fact that some people are staying is absolutely connected to the fact that we are now providing protective presence. There has been, as I said, certain indications of a small impact of international pressure, but you really have to handle it, hand it to the bravery and determination of some Palestinians to stay in their homes.
There's an article, the headline is, "If Settler Violence Wasn't Enough, Israel is Now Depriving Jordan Valley Palestinians of Water." And I think it's important to bring out the point that they're not just being expelled by intimidation and violent threats and destruction of their farms and their homes, but also by being deprived of water, their livestock can't. Not only they have a hard time drinking, they can buy water occasionally, right? You mentioned that, but their livestock is dying. You brought up in a webinar that I watched a month ago that dogs were eating dead sheep. They were so hungry, and the sheep had just died because there's no food for them. If these people don't have their livestock, they don't have their livelihood, then they leave.
Right. I do have to say that afterwards, if there was a question whether they died of hunger or some kind of a disease. But either way, you are absolutely right that the violence intimidation is only one of the punches to the gut that shepherding communities are suffering from. The second is the economic blow. Okay. If you are a shepherd, you're living on the edge to begin with, for a very, very difficult balance between bought feed and grazing. And when settlers, the army, whoever, prevents you from getting to your grazing lands, you have to buy more and more feed. Many of these communities, even before the war, were buying, needing to buy 2 to 3 times more feed, selling off their flocks because they couldn't afford it anymore. And then there can be the water issues. And then the third blow, which is the demolition orders and this and all the other ways the state is directly or indirectly supporting all of this. And now there's another economic part of it. You know that from basically November to March, a shepherd who's selling milk products, some sell their flocks for meat, but for milk products, you have almost nothing to sell because the sheep are pregnant and there just isn't the milk available. And what normally, in a normal year, what one would do would be you sell some of your sheep to make money to be able to buy more feed to tide you over until March when you can start selling more milk products again. But the amount of feed that you got to buy, as I said, is now much greater. As a result of the Russian-Ukrainian war, feed is much more expensive. And the other thing is, many of these communities are saying nobody wants to buy sheep from us. With the uncertainty of everything with this war, people are saying, why would I buy sheep right now? Why would I try to maintain a flock right now?
Yeah, we have a couple of minutes, Eric. So let me just say a couple of things real quickly. One is that your organization, Torat Tzedek, T-O-R-A-T and T-Z-E-D-E-K, Torat Tzedek, Google it. I urge listeners who are engaged in this conversation, listening to it, to support your organization. Not only are you protecting Palestinians, but as far as I know, when you can, you also are providing them with feed and trying to have their livelihood survive. And you mentioned earlier, fewer and fewer and fewer Israelis and internationalists are willing to put their body and their lives on the line protecting the Palestinians. You've almost been killed, for God's sakes. I was with you in 2015, and you invited me to go to a a olive harvest and accompany Palestinians. I had to go to the airport. You went, and that was actually the day a settler came within an inch of stabbing you, who actually, you know, they caught him, and apparently you wanted to be compassionate because he was a minor, and he just did community service for almost killing you. They also attempted to sabotage your car at one time. They loosened the lug nuts, and almost two wheels fell off. You could have been killed. And right now, the danger is the highest it's ever been. So I just commend you for your work, and just wish you, I know you practice nonviolence, but holy moly, I mean, the work that you and the others are doing is absolutely incredible.
Well, thank you so much. And to do this work, you have to be willing to take certain risks. If I had to slightly rephrase Rabbi Nachman of Bratislava's statement that all the world is a narrow bridge and the important thing is not to be afraid at all, I would say the important thing is not to be afraid too much to the point that it paralyzes you. But there are reasons to be afraid, and it's stupid if you just ignore that entirely. I thank you for plugging, supporting Torah Tzedek, and also that you'll see that we even have a dedicated link through the New Israel Fund that you can send us those donations. And in addition, the emergency campaign you mentioned is crucial. If you write to us at Torat, T-O-R-A-T dot Tzedek, T-Z-D-E-K, at gmail.com, and you've made a donation and say, I want this percentage of our donation to be for emergency aid, we will do that, because these displaced...
15 seconds.
...need incredible, incredible, incredible amounts of support. And it does take the world to stand with these people.
Okay, we have to end it there. We have to end it there. Inshallah. This is KALW San Francisco Bay Area. Thank you so very much, Arik.